I would bet that just about every one of you here this morning has seen the movie The Wizard of Oz. I can still remember those days as a young child when, long before the advent of video cassettes, my family would gather in the living room to watch it that one day a year it was broadcast on the television. It has become a film classic, as you well know, but the story originally written by Frank Baum is more than a piece of family entertainment. It is a parable of American life. Young Dorothy, snatched by a tornado from her farm home in black and white Kansas, awakens in the technicolor world of Oz, resplendent with the delights of our childlike imaginations. And yet no sooner does she arrive than she longs for home. So she begins a pilgrimage to the Emerald City, where she is told the great Wizard of Oz can fulfill her longing to return to Kansas. Along the way, she meets three fellow pilgrims who join her quest to make petitions of the great wizard, a scarecrow needing a brain, a tin man needing a heart, and a lion lacking courage. When they finally arrive and eventually are ushered into the presence of the wizard, the pilgrims are terrified by what they see and hear. The awesome flashes of light and the billows of smoke and the thunderous voice. That is, until Dorothy's little dog, Toto, pulls aside a curtain in one corner of the great hall, revealing a little old man operating buttons and levers, speaking into a microphone, and looking very much like the medicine show huckster back in Kansas. This is the wonderful Wizard of Oz? But all of his terrifying splendor is contrived. It's manufactured. It's the product of technology. The consequence of savvy marketing? In reality, the wizard, much to his own embarrassment, has never had the ability to deliver the gifts sought by these pilgrims. But then again, what becomes very quickly apparent is that they don't need him to. And that is the point of the story. What, after all, has taken place along the path of their pilgrimage? The scarecrow has revealed his ability to think. The tin man has displayed his heartfelt compassion. Even the lion has proved his bravery. In other words, they had already saved themselves. The need of the wizard then was only to certify their accomplishments. Baum's story, you see, is a perfect parable of self-reliant American individualism. It was captured several years ago by the lyrics to that old pop song, "Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man," that he didn't already have. In other words, all the sufficiency we need is inside of us. What's more, any expression of awe in response to a power external to ourselves is nothing more than childlike foolishness, because in the end, that source of power will prove to be a fantasy. It's not real. So don't cower in awe of anyone. Don't stand and tremble before anyone. Whatever appears to be awesome can be inevitably explained like a deceptive wizard hiding behind a curtain. Real power is within. These two dispositions accompany one another quite frequently, beloved. An expanding sense of self-sufficiency inevitably results in a decreased susceptibility to the experience of awe. That nothing or no one in this world is worthy of our wonder. It is the story that characterizes the people of our own age, our own culture. It is the developing spirit of our age and our culture As human beings have become increasingly convinced that the power to save themselves resides within, so simultaneously they have decreasingly proven susceptible to the experience of awe. After all, why should we tremble at what we ourselves have the power to produce? And this, you see, is the reason why in our own day, so many people no longer tremble at the idea of God anymore. Any God, for that matter. Something, by the way, beloved, that just 100 years ago was not only the common phenomenon among people who claimed to be Christians, it was the common phenomenon among people who even claimed to be confessing unbelievers. But now here we are, you see. Our technological achievements have made us more self-sufficient than ever before. We are now even on the brink of cloning human life. I bet it's already been done somewhere. Is there anything we can't do given enough time? God, on the other hand, if one even dares to believe that such a being exists, seems to be deteriorating with time. He's kind of like the wizard. A tired old man, grabbing in frustration at switches and levers in a futile attempt to stay one step ahead of us, feverishly doing everything he can to keep from being exposed for who he really is by a culture desperately wanting to tear away the curtain that hides him. Beloved, this is how modern Western culture thinks about God. If we are going to do evangelism in this culture, we need to have this perspective rumbling around in our own mind. It is one of the primary chief hallmarks of postmodernism. What is the word that characterizes our generation over against all other words? Whatever. Whatever. Where God is concerned, it's the loss of awe. Snuffed out by unprecedented self-sufficiency. Whatever. Our culture swaggers in its rejection of the transcendent, the numinous, the awesome. This is why, then, it is so fitting for us to come to this revelation, this vision in Revelation 4 and 5. As I've already hinted, and as you've no doubt detected by reading it simply, we are now ushered into something altogether new. A scene change of great significance. For the last several weeks, as you know, our context has been 7 churches in Western Asia Minor. Their strengths, their weaknesses, their victories, their failings, commendations, criticisms. Now, however, there is a change of venue. It is not a time change, I would exhort you to appreciate. It is a scene change, a change in panorama. We've been at ground level, as it were, watching from the 50-yard line. Now we move to the vantage point of the end zone. Same play, same game, different vantage point. Or better yet, from the Goodyear blimp. In other words, our vision is elevated from earth to heaven. And in these 2 chapters, my friends, there is one word that appears 19 times. All by itself, that ought to direct your attention to the emphasis of these chapters. It does introduce us to the central symbol of the entire revelation of Jesus Christ. It is the word throne. Now, I'm mindful of the fact, beloved, that we bring cultural limitations to a word like throne, a concept like throne. We don't live in a monarchy, let alone a totalitarian monarchy, which means that we lack something of the context necessary to fully appreciate the meaning of this symbol. But in the minds of these first century Christians, there was no ambiguity regarding this symbol, I assure you. A throne meant sovereignty. And here, seen in heaven, it serves as a symbol of the universal, comprehensive, absolute sovereignty of God. From this throne, the revolving planets receive their orders. To this throne, the giant galaxies give their allegiance. By this throne, the tiniest living thing derives its life. before this throne, angels and human beings, all of the created things in heaven above and earth below, bow down in humble worship. It is this throne, ultimately, that will prove to be the cause of genuine awe in every human being, the sight of which will instantly consume every expression of self-sufficiency. Revelation 4 and 5 is about the throne, God's throne. In fact, in many ways, beloved, you know, it's as though John puts himself in reverse, backs up to the beginning, and starts this revelation all over again. As many scholars have openly acknowledged, following the general introduction of chapter 1, the book of Revelation really has two starting points. The earthly situation of the seven churches in Asia Minor, and now this glorious vision of God's sovereignty in heaven. But why this dual starting point, this dual perspective? It's so those struggling churches in Asia Minor, facing real persecution from what appears to be the unstoppable power of Rome, might come to see their situation from a cosmic vantage point, from the perspective of the God who is sovereign over all things. On the one hand, beloved, as we have seen, this is not escapism. They must overcome in faithful allegiance to Jesus Christ. That's why John begins with chapters 2 and 3. On the other hand, however, John wants us to know that there is more to the reality of our experience than meets the eye. How did things appear to those early Christians? In much the same way they appear to us right now. The powers of evil steadily challenge God's rule. They mock God's authority. At times throughout human history, they have masqueraded themselves as the ultimate power over all things. In the case of Rome, actually claiming divinity. But chapters 4 and 5, beloved, are here to tell us that the earth is not the ultimate sphere of reality. Heaven is. And what is true there will inevitably become true throughout all of the created realm. In heaven, God reigns. And at this very moment, that sovereignty is acknowledged in full. Consequently, we can be certain that it will prevail in this, the very arena where it has been so vehemently challenged. Now, for these beleaguered Christians, feeling the pressures of their pagan culture to renounce Jesus Christ, a fresh experience of awe is needed. A renewed encounter with sovereignty. A vision of the throne of God to assure them that not only does God possess all the knowledge of the events of history, He has in fact decreed them and controls them. Now, chapters 4 and 5 comprise one vision divided into two parts. Conveniently, that division occurs precisely at our chapter break. And to appreciate something of the relationship between these two parts, we can say it like this. The first part is to the second part, as a stage setting is to a stage drama. In other words, in chapter 4, we find a context set for us. And in so doing, our breath is taken away in awe of the vision of the throne room of God. And then, in chapter 5, the story itself begins to unfold. God's plot line to save His people through the victory of His Son, Jesus Christ. Now, with that in mind, let's read the introduction to this vision. After this, I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. Now, friends, the Bible does not use the word heaven to only speak of one particular place. Perhaps you know this. Sometimes the word is used simply to refer to the region where the birds fly. On other occasions, the Bible uses this word in a more expansive sense to speak of the region where the stars shine. But John's ascent into heaven here is not one that could be made in either a hot air balloon or a spaceship. It refers here, rather, to what Paul refers to elsewhere as the third heaven. Now, you must not think of this, beloved, in technical categories of astronomy. The Bible is not a science book. It makes no attempt to convey itself as a science textbook. It is a way simply of referring to the place where God dwells, the place where heavenly realities are made plain, a transcendent place, a place separate from this created realm. Well, the text tells us that John sees something in heaven. He sees a door standing open. Take note of the fact, beloved, that he doesn't see the door opening. When he sees it, the tense in the original suggests, it has already been opened and it is standing opened, as though he is expected and heaven is waiting for him. And the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here." Now, as John clearly implies, this is not the first time he has been arrested by this trumpet-like voice. Back in chapter 1, we heard this voice for the first time. And there, it is the authoritative voice of the one who is the glorified Son of Man. The one who, by virtue of his death, resurrection, and ascension into heaven, has been invested with universal authority. This is the voice of Jesus Christ, the one who has fulfilled the great promise of Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man, who has entered into glory on behalf of a race he intends to save. This, beloved, is the voice John now hears again in this authoritative summons. Come up here! Properly speaking, friends, that's not an invitation. It's a command there. Come up here! To what end? And I will show you what must take place, literally, after these things. Now, beloved, we cannot go back and unpack this for you, but I would remind you that in chapter 1 we discovered this little phrase, "after these things," is a phrase John borrows from the book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 2, that puts us in the context of what the Bible calls the last days. And in the Bible, the last days are clearly the times following the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We are in the last days. The book of Hebrews tells us this. Several New Testament passages make this very apparent. We are in the last days. The last days are the periods between that period of time between the first and second coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Now, the reason why I make that clear to you, friends, is so you will understand what is in view here is not an advance in the sequence of actual historical events, as though everything Jesus has now said to the churches has been realized, and thus we are now stepping into a future period of time. In other words, quote unquote, according to the typical dispensational scheme, the church age is now done, and now we are entering into this altogether different thing called the Great Tribulation. We've already discovered from Revelation chapter 1, we're in tribulation. He's talking about the last days, our period, our time. That's what he has in view. After John has heard from Jesus the letters to the seven churches, he now hears from him a second time. And in fact, beloved, what we will now steadily come to discover over the coming weeks and even months is that the symbolic visions that begin here and extend through the end of the book serve to provide us a heavenly narrative that more fully explains the abstract material that was contained in chapters 2 and 3. Let me see if I can illustrate this. You've all been to the airport. When you look out those big plate glass windows, what do you see? Airplanes landing, airplanes taking off, airplanes taxiing to and taxiing from various gates, trucks, gasoline trucks, food service trucks, cars, people, trailers, baggage going every which way. It all looks so chaotic and out of control. But if you were escorted up to the control tower, where you could see the overall plan of the airport and listen to the various controllers passing out their directives, a great deal of what was going on down below would suddenly make much more sense. And that is what this is. John, as it were, is now transported into the control tower for the entire universe. To what end? To the end that a great deal of what was discussed in chapters 2 and 3 will now make much more sense. John will see the controller and something of his plans. Now, admittedly, even John may not be able to fully comprehend the implications of those plans from that lofty vantage point. But the point is this, he will now know that there is a throne from which everything is being perfectly controlled. And did you see, beloved, right here what hinted at this very thing? In fact, it's not a hint. It's stated rather explicitly. Jesus says, come up here and I will show you what, look at that next word, you need to circle it in your Bible, must take place after these things. Without belaboring the language at this point, that is a phrase, that is a particular verb in the Greek text that speaks of divine predestination. It is one of John's favorite words, and every time he uses it, it's in the mouth of Jesus. I will show you what must take place. Not I will show you what will take place, as though the only issue in view is foreknowledge. No, I will show you what must take place. But the only way that can be done is if the events John is about to see have been foreordained by the will of God. That's the very point of this, beloved. What does that throne symbolize? God's absolute sovereignty. Beloved, I say to you again, as I often say when we come to these kinds of themes in the Bible, please, crush the spirit of this age under your foot. That spirit which says, I don't want to think, I want to feel. Who can ever understand God's sovereignty anyway? It's too big. This is the domain of Christian theologians. I want to tell you something, beloved. God's sovereignty is not a piece of theological lumber you can afford to live without. It is not a philosophical conundrum for the intellectual elite. God's sovereignty is a soft pillow for a weary head. To comfort Christians under attack, Christians facing opposition, and even in some cases anticipating the reality of martyrdom. Come up to the control tower, John, and let me give you a look. Let me show you what must take place. At this, John writes, immediately, I was in the Spirit. Now, John said the same thing back in chapter 1, didn't he? I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. So is this simply a continued state of this prophetic inspiration? Or perhaps is this a heightened state of prophetic inspiration? Maybe some time has elapsed between these two visions so that his first experience in the Spirit came to an end and now it resumes again. I don't know. And was John's actual body transported into heaven or is this occurring in the realm of his mind? I don't know. It comforts me to know that when Paul had a similar experience, he didn't know either. Whether I was in the body or apart from the body, I don't know, he said. Those details are irrelevant. The key question is, what did John see when he got there? And that's for today and next Lord's Day. He saw several things. This morning we'll only consider the first. He saw the ineffable glory of this sovereign God. He saw the ineffable glory of this sovereign God. And there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian, a rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. What in the world is this? How do you draw it? Let me help you appreciate something of what's taking place here, friends, by drawing an analogy. It may not be a very good one, so if it bombs here, I won't use it in the second service. Let me try it out on you. I guess next week we won't have that opportunity. Let's suppose that suddenly you are transported to the most remote corner of Papua New Guinea, where even at this hour, people have barely entered into the Stone Age. By and by, over time, you master their language. Now here is your assignment: to explain the concept of electricity. How do you explain electricity to people still living in the Stone Age? I'd like to teach you about electricity today. Well, you don't have a word for electricity, so I'm going to teach you a new word. It's not even in your vocabulary. Electricity. Electricity. It's kind of like a powerful spirit that runs along hard things that are kind of like vines that we stretch from tree to tree. Actually, we chop the tree down, cut off all its branches, and then put it back into the ground again so that we can hang all these hard vines on them. These vines that we make in a factory, but don't worry, you don't know what a factory is. Through these hard vines that we hang on trees that we cut down and replant, this powerful spirit travels through lickety-split. What's your word for lickety-split? Really fast. On one end of these really hard vines is a place where we pump this spirit into these hard vines through which it travels lickety-split, and we can connect them to a special box kind of thing in your mud hut. And these are people in the Stone Age. So on the top of this box kind of thing in your mud hut are other kinds of things that go round and round like a circle. And when the spirit comes through those vines into this little box, those round things will get really, really hot so that you'll be able to heat your water without having to make a fire in your mud hut. What's more, if you connect those hard vines to your thatched roof and the spirit goes in there, you can have your own little sun in your mud hut so that you can stay up all night and read War and Peace. I don't know. What do they do? How am I doing at explaining electricity? Of course, I've not said anything at all yet about the molecular, atomic, or subatomic dimensions of electricity. Said nothing about protons or neutrons, volts, amps, ohms. Said nothing about semiconductors. Nothing about how this power is generated, where it's stored. How am I doing explaining electricity? You say, well, you're not doing very well. Well, what's the matter with these people? Are they stupid or something? No. The fact of the matter is, when they emigrate to this country, their children will outdo ours. They'll try harder. They'll make more effort. It'll take two or three generations, at least, before their children dumb down to the rest of ours. They're not stupid. Their problem is an utter lack of experience in this area. They lack the categories necessary to even imagine what electricity is. Well then, how shall we describe the throne room of God? How shall one human being explain a vision of the throne room of God to another who has not been there and who lacks the very categories necessary to comprehend? How do you describe a God who is whiter and purer, morally speaking, than the driven snow? How do you describe a God who is more magnificent than the most stunning sunset? How do you describe a God who is more entrancing than a million twinkling stars? How do you describe a God, a knowledge of whom is more... ...of foods? How do you describe a God whose love is more faithful and understanding than the ideal mother? How do you describe a God who is more awesome than all of the unleashed forces of nature? How do you describe a God like that? Beloved, have you noticed? The thing that is absolutely amazing about this vision is that there is no description of God here. Only similes, only analogies. Why? Lest we create an image. Because you see, even the most glorious image we could ever come up with ultimately reduces Him. You see, beloved, when that which produces awe can be thoroughly explained, it ceases to be awesome. That's what happened to the Wizard of Oz. What John here sees is ineffable. That is to say, it is indescribable. It is too overwhelming to be definitively described. We've not got the categories. The closest thing we have is this language of apocalyptic, which to be sure is very highly evocative, but it leaves you with nothing you can draw. So John speaks of these infinite realities using earthly analogies, but all the while understanding that the heavenly reality far exceeds the earthly symbol. There before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. Now there is the first guarantee of victory. You will discover this, beloved, again and again, becoming most pronounced even next Lord's Day, that one of the burdens of the revelation is to tell us that there are multi-levels of thrones when you talk about heaven and earth. There's a certain level of thrones, and above that there is another set of thrones, and above that there is another set of thrones, and ultimately above all other thrones, there stands one throne. A throne above Caesar's throne. A sovereignty above Caesar's sovereignty. In fact, beloved, I think it would do us well to note that the judgments of God which are enacted against His enemies, beginning in chapter 6 and extending through chapter 16, are all pictured as issuing forth from God's throne. What is it that we will see standing at the end of time before which all people will bow in submission? A great white throne. John says, I saw it. Someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. Now, friends, there is something you need to keep in mind when we take a look at this, and that is that the people of the ancient Middle East did not employ our classifications of precious stones. Therefore, sometimes it is a bit difficult for us to know exactly which stone is being spoken of, especially in terms of color. The jasper that John here mentions, for example, was most likely not like our jasper today, which is sometimes green or yellow, sometimes even brown, and most importantly, opaque. So what is this stone? Well, it's mentioned again in chapter 21, verse 11, where we're told that the New Jerusalem shines with the glory of God and that its brilliance was like that of a very precious jewel, like jasper, clear as crystal. And that word crystal there can also be translated ice. Consequently, most scholars believe that this jasper refers to something like our diamond. In other words, it's not opaque, a stone that refuses to let any light through. Nor is it merely translucent, like frosted glass, letting some light pass through, but diffusing it so it's only partially distinguished. This stone is crystal clear. It sparkles, it shimmers, it's transparent. Light can pass through it so easily it can even be painful to the eyes. And then John mentions a carnelian. And about this, we're a bit more certain. It was a stone that possessed a beautifully deep reddish color. It was said that when light passed through a carnelian, the inside of it looked like a smoldering fire. Again, it reflected light. Now, some of you may be mindful of the fact that there have been people throughout the years who've attempted to assign specific theological meaning to these colors. The crystal clear jasper, they suggest, symbolizes God's holiness. The carnelian symbolizes God's wrath. The emerald green in the next line refers to God's mercy. But what I want to ask you, beloved, is that there anything in the text that gives us clues that this is in John's mind or that this was John's intention? Anything in the rest of the Bible that would incline us to think about color in that way? There's nothing to that effect. It's like suggesting that the scarlet cord in the story of Rahab is a symbol of redemption. The cord was red, the blood of Jesus is red, oh my goodness, there's redemption. It's ridiculous. You can talk about redemption from Rahab, but you don't have to do it on the basis of color. Which, of course, would be a very much a contradiction with the red carnelian stone here, which is thought by the same group of people to symbolize wrath. So what is all of this? Well, I think that there's a great insight we can get from other portions of the Bible, other hints. For example, the psalmist says that God wraps himself in light as with a garment. God's clothing, as it were, is his glory, his light, his radiance. Beloved, when Moses departed from the immediate presence of Yahweh, what was it that radiated from his face? The light of the glory of God. In Ezekiel's vision of the throne room of God, very much like this one, I might add, he says that brilliant light surrounded him. Paul describes the Lord, 1 Timothy chapter 6, as dwelling in unapproachable light. It is the light of his glory, the radiance, the effulgence of his Shekinah, his glory. Moreover, beloved, we know from other apocalyptic literature of this period that it was a common thing to liken the glory of a heavenly figure to precious gemstones without specific meaning being attached to each one. That it was simply a traditional way of illustrating the unspeakable glory and wealth and beauty of a particular heavenly personage. And I think that's how we need to approach this business here. Not to subjectively read meaning into each color, but rather to see these stones for what they were designed to do, as intensifying the light around the throne, reflecting the unapproachable brightness of the glory of God. It's a spectacular scene. You know what I find to be much more compelling, beloved, in terms of helping us at this point? Each of these three stones, jasper, carnelian, emerald, is mentioned later on in the Revelation. You know where? In the recreation of all things. They make up the foundation stones of the New Jerusalem. That place, I would remind you, where there will be no specific temple of God as distinguished from the rest of creation, but that all of creation will be temple when the resplendent glory of God will pervade every inch of that place. John says, I saw it there. How then shall we talk about the throne room of God, given the fact that we lack the apparatus to comprehend His glory? In the words of Calvin, this is all baby talk. The glory of that place was ineffable. For all of these words, beloved, did you notice the throne is not described, nor the person sitting on it? The categories of our language are not up to the task. All John can do is speak in weak analogies, like the appearance of a jasper, like the appearance of a carnelian. It's the beauty and splendor of the glory of God. And now this, a rainbow resembling an emerald encircled the throne. Interestingly, instead of revealing all of the manifold colors of the prism, this rainbow was emerald. Green in color. But, beloved, Why a rainbow? Why here? A rainbow? Who do you think about in the Bible when you read about a rainbow? What event in redemptive history? That event when God judged the entire human race and flooded the earth. That event when every man, every woman, every boy, every girl was judged by the hand of God. But for His people, God provided a means of deliverance, an ark. And when that judgment came to an end, what sign did God give to His people so as to indicate He would never again destroy the earth with a flood? The sign of God's covenant to them was a rainbow. A bow hung in the sky. Why a bow? What did a bow mean to people in that day? Living in the days of Noah and immediately following, before a bow ever hung in the sky, what did a bow mean to those people? To be sure, it was a tool for acquiring food. But in particular, beloved, it was a weapon with which to make war. And after a war had been waged and won, what would the people do with their bows? Hang them up on a wall, perhaps above a mantle, over a hearth. That's what God did. That bow in the sky was a symbol that for the time God's wrath had been put to rest. He has hung up His war bow for all to see. I will never again destroy as I did in that flood. Now, beloved, did that mean that God would never again exercise judgment on behalf of the human race? There's an old Appalachian spiritual that goes like this. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. God gave Noah the rainbow sign. Won't be water, but fire next time. Yahweh hung up His war bow in the clouds as a sign that He would restrain His anger. But we know from the rest of the Word of God and the Revelation itself that He will pull it down again, and that from this very throne, God's judgment will once again be poured out. But for His people, like John, like these frail and weary Christians resisting the pressures to renounce Jesus Christ, there is a rainbow around that throne. The promise that they need not fear God's judicial wrath, but that to them He will always be gracious. That from Him they will always know mercy. That because they have entered into the ark of Jesus Christ, the war bow of God on their account has been hung up forever. How then shall we talk about the throne room of God? This is where it all begins. It's a place of ineffable glory. A place that inspires awe and dread, and yet for the people of God, a place of promised grace. This is the God you need, my friends. If you are not a Christian here this morning, this is the God you need. He is not a weak and frustrated God, pulling levers, hiding behind curtains, seeking to deceive. This is the God of absolute sovereignty, whose glory defies all powers of human explanation. All we can say is, His glory is ineffable. What a way to restore perspective for life on this side of the door. Now you come back next week. and we'll step back inside it once again. Would you bow your heads with me, please? Our great and mighty God, we are humbled by this vision of your glory. And yet it is obvious that John needed it, those Christians needed it, and we need it. We needed to remind us that this world, this earth, is not the ultimate determiner of what is real and true. That there is, even now at this very moment, a throne in heaven surrounded by angelic creatures who do not cease to declare the majesty of who you are. Father, as we look at this passage, we realize there's not one command here given to us. We're not given 6 steps to follow. We're not given a list of things that we need to now go out and do. It's simply here for us to know and to feel awe, to be humbled in your glory, to be humbled in your presence. We are thankful that for we who are Christians, it's not that the glory is lessened in any way. It's not that the awe is in any way compromised. But we are thankful that from that very place there is grace. A rainbow which reminds us that by virtue of what you have done in Jesus Christ, you are no longer angry with us. We love you and we thank you for that. And Father, I pray that as we now proceed through this vision in the coming weeks, that the response of the angels would be our response. That it would arouse from us a kind of worship that we have yet to experience, that we have yet to express in declaring your glory. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.